From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, Chicano artist Jose Montoya. His new book, A Story He Wrote and Illustrated, reads from right to left. Also, why this year's Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival is almost entirely made up of music concerts. And Spamalot, you'll meet some of the stars of the current music circus production. First, do California state workers make more or less than their private sector counterparts? State scientists say they make less, and it's an issue in the public pension debate. Last week, you might recall I spoke about public pensions with an economist at the Reason Foundation, a libertarian-leaning think tank. Adam Summers says the cost of public pensions is too high. He also says state workers are no longer paid less than their private sector counterparts. Well, we then heard from state scientists who say they have labor market surveys that prove they are paid considerably less than scientists in the private sector. Joining me are a state scientist, also the staff director of the California Association of Professional Scientists. We'll start with him, Christopher Voigt. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, do scientists working for the state of California make less money than their counterparts in the private sector?
Generally, yes. The data, though, isn't clear on that relationship because data from the private sector is generally not available. Our comparisons are, for the most part, with scientists who work for other public sector jurisdictions, local government, the federal government, and those numbers are very clear. State scientists in comparable classes do make less.
Give examples of some of those other public sector scientists that you compare the California scientists with.
Veterinarian, for example. Veterinarians are really essential in the public health programs for the Department of Food and Agriculture. The state of California right now really can't hire veterinarians because the universities, local government, where they're needed, pay far more.
When you say universities, are you including UC Davis and the CSU system?
Yes, they have strong veterinary programs, not just in California, but in programs in other states.
So you're not including them in the category of state scientists?
No.
Okay.
No,
so
our state scientists are a little different than theirs, and the university systems pay more, but in local government as well. Another more commonly used classification is microbiologist, and these scientists do, essential public work in support of preventing the spread of West Nile virus, H1N1 swine flu, and are essential to the Richmond Lab, which is a state-of-the-art lab in the Bay Area that works on public health programs.
To the extent that you can compare state scientists with private sector counterparts, what do you know about that?
Well, where we find data, they make a lot less than the private sector. But it's not the money that attracts scientists to public service and to state government. And that's something that maybe Yvonne can get into. I mean, she is a scientist. She's worked in it throughout her career. But where the numbers are available, yeah, state scientists make a lot less.
Well, the Yvonne that Christopher Voigt mentioned was Yvonne Adassi, who's a senior environmental scientist at the Office of Spill Prevention and Response, which is part of the California Department of Fish and Game. Yvonne, welcome.
Thank you.
What do you and your colleagues, other scientists who work for the state of California, make of the discrepancy between what you and your colleagues make and your counterparts at other public sector agencies?
Well, I think it's difficult, I think, for public workers. You know, we came to public service because we feel strongly and passionately about what we do. So at Fish and Game, you know, we are trustee agencies. We work for the benefit of people of the state. And it's difficult. In my instance, I work in oil spills. So as an example, during the Costco Busan spill, you would show up and work long hours and working alongside of folks who sometimes used to work for the state and then took jobs either in the private sector and consulting or in some of local governments because it was hard for them to stay with the state because they made more in other sectors.
Christopher Voigt said that California state scientists tend to make less than not just the counterparts in the private sector, but also the counterparts at other government agencies. If you're not motivated by the money, but by public service, why not at least work for another public sector agency that pays more?
Well, I think that that's an individual question for different people. I know that, as an example, at UC Davis, there's the Oiled Wildlife Care Network, and I know that those are people who we work with fairly closely during oil spills, cleaning up oiled wildlife, those types of things. And I think it depends on what it is that you like to do. and how it is that you want to make your contribution to the state and to the people of the state.
We're talking about the pay scales for California state scientists and a related topic, public pensions. We started this last week when we talked, I talked with a libertarian economist who said public pensions are costing too much. And he also says that public sector workers don't make less than the private sector counterparts. He said that was true at one time, but not anymore. But state scientists say, in fact, they do make less money than their private sector counterparts. And incidentally, there are counterparts in other parts of the public sector. Christopher Voigt, staff director of the California Association of Professional Scientists. Why do scientists for the state government make less than the counterparts in both the private sector and other government agencies?
It's largely the result of budget deficits.
But that applies to everyone, surely.
Well, it does. I can't speak to the other jobs within state government. I have been around state scientists for years, and I find that they are really a dedicated lot that love the work of public service. And over time, as they grow in their careers, they have families. They look forward to getting reasonable increases in the cost of living reflected in their paychecks. That hasn't happened, and hasn't happened largely because of the policies of the state and because of the inability to balance the budget. So they have really suffered in that respect. But these people continue to work in public service because they love the work and the public benefits from it.
Well, you said that you can't really speak to other job sectors for the state government, but I'm sure you have some idea. How do scientists compare with other large categories of workers at the California state government compared to their counterparts elsewhere? Are scientists worse off or the same?
Well, again, there's a lot of different categories.
Sure.
Of public state employees. There's public safeties. The professional occupations. I would say from the professional occupations, they've lagged. Physicians, dentists, engineers, scientists. They've lagged quite a bit, and a lot of it is the result of budget deficits. But people stick with it. They love their work, and they're going to continue doing it because it benefits public health and safety.
Yvonne Adassi, when this issue came up in our program last week, we received several very strongly worded emails. That's a nice way to put it.
Okay.
From state scientists and others at the state government objecting to what Adam Summers at the Reason Foundation was saying about pay and pensions in the public sector. I don't know if you're angry as well about it, but how would you describe the feelings among state scientists at this time regarding their pay and their pensions, given that there's clearly a debate over the general affordability of pensions and pay in the public sector?
Well, I think it's a complicated question. I'll try and answer it in the vein that you asked it. Right now, as you know, state workers are getting, and scientists are one category of that, are getting paid minimum wage. And so we are being asked to go out and continue doing our work as professionals, some of us working overtime. We have a number of folks working down at the Gulf Spill right now who are theoretically also making minimum wage. So I think that Chris alluded to it earlier. None of us came to state service to become millionaires by any means. We enjoy the work that we do. We enjoy the people that we do it with. But I don't think any of us thought that we were going to lose real buying power. We haven't had the last cost of living we had was in 2007. And the cost of living before that is, I can't honestly remember.
But a lot of people haven't had pay increases or have had less than normal pay increases over the last couple of years.
No, I'm not talking about pay increases. I'm not talking about raises. I'm talking about keeping up with inflation.
Well, I'm talking about that too.
Okay. So, and then in terms of pensions, I mean, a number of us came into state service and the pension was a part of the contract that we signed into. And so being able to work long hours, being able to do what it is that we need to do on behalf of the people of the state, whether it's keeping your school safe, making sure that they're not being built on Superfund sites, or that the water that you drink is safe, or that the food that you eat doesn't have undue pesticides on it. This is the work that we do as state scientists, as well as maintaining parks and fish and wildlife resources. There's a number of things that we do. And we will continue to do it because this is a part of who we are. But I also think that it is a part of the trust that we signed on as scientists to do that.
I got an email from a fairly well-known state scientist, Alyssa Lynn, who's a meteorologist, works for the state of California now, but used to work on TV at News 10. And she says meteorologists make 30 to 50% less than private meteorologists or federal meteorologists. Christopher Voigt, does that sound right to you?
Yeah. You know, Alyssa's a good friend and now a CAPS member, formerly in your business, in the media business, and a very, very sharp woman who now serves the public in that capacity. I think the thing that she's concerned about, I'm concerned about, a lot of us are really are disappointed in, is the vilification of public employees for the problems, the budget problems of this state. We hear it all over the place. We hear it about retirement, and it's wrong. Even the discussion of minimum wage it's just wrong to pay employees minimum wage because policymakers cannot arrive at a decision, and the governor continues to push it. So,
although they will get repaid at the full level, presumably.
The controller says might not be for 6 months. People have endured pay cuts up to 15% for the last 17 months. And they are strapped. They are cut to the bone. They are supporting families. It is wrong to pay them minimum wage. Simply wrong.
One argument I've heard in favor of defined benefit pensions for public sector workers has traditionally been that it was sort of a trade-off for making less money in salary when one is working for the state of California or any other government body. Setting aside to what extent that is actually true, that there is a trade-off, what would you make of a proposal to say, okay, let's move state workers to 401k type pensions, as most people have nowadays, in exchange for making wages, salaries that are closer to the prevailing norm for your line of work?
Well, you're asking a bit of an economic question, and I'm not an economist.
Well, but that's a personal question, too. Which kind of financial security would you value more, making more money now in exchange for a 401k pension?
I wouldn't presume to speak for state workers, but I signed on with the state with a defined benefit program and was willing to live within the salaries that were being paid within that defined benefit program. So for me, I would prefer to maintain the defined benefit program. But again, I think that that comes down to trade-offs for people. I think that a number of us who came into state service came in under sort of a given contract. It was a number of holidays, a number of different types of benefits that you might have, and we've seen them all slowly erode.
Christopher Voigt, what do you think about that trade-off argument?
I think the trade-off argument is just it's a bad argument, and it's bad public policy to suddenly eliminate a defined benefit program for public employment generally. Our members understand and know that they're not going to see the kind of growth in salary that one administration might promise, because it just hasn't happened and it won't happen because of the vagaries of the state budget. One thing they can depend on is a minimum and basic retirement that provides them some sustenance during retirement. It's not unlike some of the statements that have been made in recent months and the last couple of years, exorbitant or outrageous. It's very reasonable.
What about new employees, setting aside people who are already in the system with a defined benefit pension? What about new employees? Would you accept that trade-off being made there? Higher salaries, perhaps, in exchange for a 401k pension?
Well, that hasn't been offered, and it won't be offered.
I realize that, but people talk about it.
No, I don't think it's a good idea. I mean, these decisions are made by the organization through the context of contract bargaining, and I don't think we'd accept that because it wouldn't happen. Our members are concerned not just about their own retirement and their own positions, but the future of public science in government. And if they eliminate or change drastically that basic retirement program, the state will become even less an attractive place to work. It will erode the essential public science programs that currently exist.
And Yvonne, same question for you. You're currently working for the state. Keep your defined benefit pension. What about scientists who don't yet work for the state, having a separate contract for them? In other words, they're on a separate pay scale, but they also don't have a defined benefit pension.
Well, I think that Chris answered that fairly well. I think there is there is the way that the actuarials work and how it is that you can maintain that system over time. But one of the things that we are concerned about as scientists, as well as people who live in the state, is what's going to happen in 10 years when 30% of state scientists are likely going to retire. And how are you going to bring in those young, talented people? You know, we sponsor science fairs around the state. We have a State Scientist Day. You know, we're working really hard to try and maintain the level of science. But if people are being asked to come in with a less benefit package, and I don't just mean retirement, I mean the whole suite of things, then what is going to bring our best and brightest to doing state work?
And I'd add one thing. This proposal isn't far off from the proposal made nationally a few years ago to privatize Social Security. The people should have a certain amount invested in a retirement. They can direct where it goes and they see what happens. This is not a program that is good for state scientists and not a good program for public service and the programs that they serve.
It is the norm for people at large in California.
Didn't used to be.
Well, it might or might not be, but the fact is, it is the norm.
Well, that may be so, but essential public programs are important for the people of California and the work that's done. And if they can't provide some minimum guarantees when salaries are depressed, it becomes even more difficult. You know, we looked at Yvonne's numbers. In fact, she's worked for the state for 20 plus years now. Mm-hmm. If you were and you would be able to retire shortly. If you were to retire soon, your retirement annuity from CalPERS would be about $2,500 a month.
Right.
That's not unreasonable.
Yvonne Adassi, did you have a quick final thought?
I think that we can get into the discussion of pensions and salaries and those types of things, but I also think that it's important that we remember that, you know, people do this job for the people of the state of California because it's important work that needs to be done, and it needs to be done at a level to ensure the public health and safety.
That's Yvonne Adassi, Senior Environmental Scientist at the Office of Spill Prevention and Response, which is part of the California Department of Fish and Game. Also with us, Christopher Voigt, Staff Director of the California Association of Professional Scientists. We have been continuing a discussion that started last week on Insight about public pay and public pensions. Christopher, Yvonne, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk about what's going on at the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you missed a previous show, check our archives at capradio.org/insight. Today on Talk of the Nation, NPR reporter Barbara Bradley Haggerty has introduced us to a new twist in murder trials, NeuroLaw. It's not quite my brain made me do it, but psychologists say that for some suspects, it sure improved the odds. Also, a new twist on boomerang kids and extended adolescence. That's Redefining Adulthood on Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. This year's Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival is almost entirely made up of music concerts of many genres. One thing you won't find is an actual Shakespeare play, although there is a production throughout the summer of the comedy show, The Complete Works of William Shakespeare Abridged. What's happening at the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival? Joining me is Charlie Fee, producing artistic director of the festival, also the director of this year's production of The Complete Works of William Shakespeare Abridged. Charlie, welcome to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Well, what was the thinking behind the lineup for this year's Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival?
Well, it's really simple, you know, and it goes like this. The company has had, three seasons in a row that were very challenging because of the economy and because of, you know, the economy within the resort communities like Lake Tahoe. And so this needed to be a season in which, when I was brought on by the board, the goal was rebuild the economic base of this company. And the way to do that is that I needed to pull the cost of production of the full Shakespeare plays down, create something really unique, super fun, you know, a piece that the audience will be totally engaged in, but get the cost of production down. And so Complete Works of Shakespeare Abridged, which is a piece that I absolutely adore, is the perfect choice. Yeah, it's not real Shakespeare, On the other hand, it's an absolutely wonderful homage to Shakespeare and a celebration of theater, and it essentially takes the audience through every Shakespeare play ever written. And I've got, you know, three actors who are extraordinary Shakespeare actors who work all over the country, and we know each other well. And so, you know, it won't feel exactly like Shakespeare. It's a little bit like Saturday Night Live meets Shakespeare.
Shakespeare tended to write big plays that need big casts. Are there no Shakespeare plays that you could put on that cost less money than, say, A Midsummer Night's Dream?
Well, are there no plays? I mean, actually, the truth is, Midsummer Night's Dream is a pretty inexpensive Shakespeare, as Shakespeare goes. Let's put it this way, Jeffrey. If you're really careful with your casting and doubling of some roles, you can get Midsummer Night's Dream down to 13 actors.
Uh-huh.
Right? Now, listen, remember, these are professional actors. They're union actors. I've got to fly them into town. I have to house them. I've got to pay for rehearsal time, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see that the cost of 13 actors plus two stage managers, all union, and my stage crew, et cetera, is quite a bit more than three actors.
The tough economy, you said, was part of the problem that faced the festival in the last couple of years, faced pretty much every organization in the United States and around the world. The economy's still bad, but it's a bit better. Was there any talk of doing something a bit more typically Shakespearean, given the slightly better economy, or is the economy really not improved enough to support that yet?
Well, remember that you're making these decisions a year ahead of time, right? And so, you know, you're in a position as a producer, like everyone else in a business, of saying, well, how much better is the economy going to be next July? And you're saying this to your board and your staff in October, right? Now, the economy has been, as you know better than I, and you're reporting it regularly, you know, it's been up a little and down a little. The stock market's been up tremendously and then came back down. Nobody can really read these tea leaves, you know, with any true precision. I'm feeling a lot more energy in Lake Tahoe this weekend of 4th of July than anybody was expecting. But I'll tell you what's tricky about it is these are late bookings. We don't know ahead of time if people are coming or staying home. Weather, of course, affects this. And, you know, the weather down in the Bay Area, in Sacramento, et cetera, it hasn't really been a great summer yet. So it's tough to know. I do think and I hope that it's going to be a stronger season than I had, you know, projected in October. But, you know, the problem with running theater companies and not-for-profits in general is that we often, you know, we're very positive people and we live on hope, you know, and we're creative and we think, oh, we can overcome all these things. And the number of people in not-for-profits who thought they could overcome these economic challenges and weren't able to, and companies have been lost to us forever, is, you know, record numbers all across the country. So my job is to build a company that can sustain itself through these tough times, rebuild in the coming years, and, you know, give us another 38 years of Shakespeare at this unbelievably beautiful site at Sand Harbor.
My guest is Charlie Fee, producing artistic director of the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival. If all goes well, would you expect to bring Shakespeare plays back next year?
Absolutely. You know, I'm looking right now at Twelfth Night. I'm looking at Two Gentlemen of Verona. I'm looking at the Scottish play. I'm looking at, you know, a whole array of pieces that we are budgeting for, trying to figure out how we can get this cost as tight as we can, but bring back full-length Shakespeare. But I got to say, Jeffrey, I predict this audience is going to go crazy for complete works.
Now, when you say the Scottish play, you are, of course, referring to Macbeth.
Absolutely.
You are relatively new to the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival as a producing artistic director. Also new is Bob Taylor, executive director of the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival. You and Bob have worked together for a long time, and you hold similar positions, as I understand, at two other companies. Is that right?
That's right. I'm artistic director at the Idaho Shakespeare Festival in Boise, Idaho, and at the Great Lakes Theater Festival in Cleveland, Ohio. And we have had that partnership going now for 9 seasons. And what we're building is a very different business model to support large-scale classic work in, you know, essentially medium-sized markets and seasonal markets. So the very thing we've been talking about, the cost of producing Shakespeare at a very high level, if you can produce it and share your work consistently with other cities, obviously you can bring the total cost of production down by spreading it over, you know, varied markets. So we're bringing Lake Tahoe in as our third member of our new team here, and so we'll be taking complete works from Lake Tahoe this summer. We'll take it to Cleveland next spring, and then back into Boise next summer. So we'll end up sharing this production between all three cities.
So you and Bob Taylor were hired as a team specifically to promote this economy of scale.
That's exactly right. I was brought in. You know, I've been talking. I grew up in the Bay Area, you know, and I came to Tahoe, you know, my childhood, going to ski in the lake. And one of my very good friends from grad school ran Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival for 14 years. And so, you know, I knew this company well. And I'd been talking to the board over a couple of years about our model that we've developed between Boise and Cleveland. And then the timing was just right for everyone this last season when I started to talk seriously about bringing Lake Tahoe into our model. And so it's a company I know, you know, well from afar, but am now working daily on.
And you studied at University of the Pacific in Stockton.
I did. That's where I did my undergraduate degree in theater.
Yes. Well, Charlie Fee, producing artistic director of the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival, thank you for joining us. The Shakespeare Festival at Lake Tahoe at Sand Harbor State Park, to be precise, happens most of July and August. Most of the festival is comprised of music concerts of a variety of genres. There's also the complete works of William Shakespeare Abridged, directed by Charlie. You going to say something?
Hey, Jeffrey, I'm so sorry to correct you. Most of the performances are complete works. There are 33 performances of complete works, and there are 11 nights of music.
I understand, but when you look at the list of all the events, there's one play-type production and then a whole bunch of music concerts. But your distinction is absolutely appropriate, and thank you for the correction. Well, Charlie, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Jeffrey. I really appreciate the time, and hope you can get up and see the play.
Thank you. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, actors from Spamalot, the Monty Python-inspired musical. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Check out Insight on Facebook and click like. Tomorrow, the tense relations between the Sacramento City Schools Administration and the Teachers Union. Also, we'll talk about some of the top stories in the news and sports with the Sacramento Bee's Marcus Bertone. Spamalot, the Monty Python-inspired musical, opens this week in Sacramento. It's the first time the show comes to town after successful runs in London, Broadway, Las Vegas, and elsewhere. This production is by Music Circus. Spamalot was written by Python member Eric Idle and based on the cult classic film Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Several cast members join us. We'll start with Gary Beach, actor who plays King Arthur in this production. He also acted in the national touring version of Spamalot. Gary Beach, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you very much.
What's the difference between Spamalot and the film Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
Oh, well, one's on film. No, the big difference for me is that I find the show, the play, the musical to be a lot more, it's easier to get into. A lot of people, when they first, well, I get it, is the big question you get from people that, mm-hmm. Well, I never liked the flying circus and a different thing altogether. You know, we have the same characters, but it's different sensibility.
A lot of the famous sketches, though, from the film are adapted for the stage version.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Did you watch the film when it came out? Did you watch Monty Python when it was on TV?
Oh, sure I did. But I was really sort of more into Mel Brooks, you know, back in the 70s and the 80s when these guys were happening. Mel Brooks was very hot, and that's where I would stand in line. Of course, I wanted to see Life of Brian and the Holy Grail and everything, but I really, it didn't speak to me the way Mel did. But now I must say that the accessibility of the musical, it's fun. It really is. You see audiences that you wouldn't, if you know, that didn't watch the Flying Circus show on television, really getting into the musical.
Well, what was your reaction when you first heard about it?
The show?
The film. The show.
Oh, the show. It'll never work. It really was. I said, oh, boy, men dressed up like women, talking up here like this, you know, and I thought, this is going to be silly. And luckily, it was really silly, and lucky for all of us right now, it was very successful.
Gary Beachy plays King Arthur in the Music Circus production of Spamalot, which opens this Friday and runs through July 18th. Also with us is Leslie Margarita, actress in the production. Leslie, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
You play the Lady in the Lake.
I do.
Tell us about the Lady in the Lake.
The Lady of the Lake is a glamorous, beautiful creature. Well, I can't tell you what happens in the end, but she is the one who has the power to take ordinary men and make them knights, make them special. And she's very special herself. She has many talents.
Yes. What did you think of the original film that Spamalot was based on?
Well, I didn't see it till much later. I grew up also watching Mel Brooks. And then when I was in college, a lot of people were always talking about Monty Python, and then I started watching them. And then when I heard about the musical, I kind of thought the same thing. I said, nobody in the States is going to care. I thought it was pretty specific. I thought people maybe in England would love it. And then when I finally saw the musical, I fell in love with it. And then I went back and watched all the Monty Python
stuff. Lady of the Lake's not in the movie.
The Lady of the Lake is not in the film. No. She's a mythological creature. You know, she's in a lot of myths.
Yeah, the Arthur legend, right.
Our third guest is John Shearer, who plays Sir Robin and other roles in Spamalot. What kind of roles do you play in addition to Sir Robin?
I play a guard.
A guard.
Funny guard.
Really funny guard. And who else do I play? I don't even know.
Well, you play the guy at the beginning that we do the very famous routine.
He's also a guard.
The brother.
Yes,
the
very
guards,
famous routine
apparently.
Of the swallow guest. May fly south with the sun. It's very famous if you're a python, you know. But no, he plays a lot. But mainly Sir Robin. And he has one of the funniest songs ever written in the second act.
Which is?
It's a great number. It's called You Won't Succeed on Broadway.
That's and a great
it's
title. Very,
it's a great It's a great number.
I get to sit on stage every night and watch it as the king, and it's a thrill and it's an honor because it's a great, great musical comedy number with a point of view that most musical comedy numbers
wouldn't dare to go to.
No,
I think that's part of the thing that you were talking earlier about, the difference between the film and the stage version. They really added the element of it being a Broadway musical, which made the whole thing much more accessible. But, I mean, literally the scenes, some of them are verbatim, the script from the film.
Yeah. We're talking about Spamalot, the Monty Python-inspired musical. It opens this week in Sacramento, a production by Music Circus. My guests are three of the cast, Gary Beach, Leslie Margarita, and John Shearer. Gary, you were in the national touring production. This is an early regional theater production, isn't it?
Right. This is the first. And the reason Sacramento Music Circus got to have the rights to this is because Spamalot was scheduled to come here as part of their season, and they closed prematurely. And so they said, okay, well, can we have the first rights? So we have the original choreography from Casey Nicola, and we have costumes from the London company. And it looks just very much like Spamalot, you know, and a lot of the same props and things. So it's early on, and we get to experiment and try to put it in the round. We've never played the round before.
So the props and the costumes from London aren't too beaten up yet.
Oh, not at all. They're very careful over there.
But by the end of these 2 weeks,
you
won't recognize them. Mm-hmm.
Leslie, you're from Northern California. Where exactly?
I am from Fremont. Grew up in Fremont. My whole family is still there. I have a sister who lives here in Sacramento.
Yes, who's actually been in our program in a previous incarnation, Lynn Margarita.
She has. Yes. Famous. So it's great to come up here and have family here. I live in Los Angeles now, so I'm not too far.
Where you have an acclaimed nightclub act, your bio says.
I do. I've been doing it for a while, and I do it all over Los Angeles.
What is it? All Hail the Queen?
It's called All Hail the Queen, and it's kind of Bette Midler-y. It's got a bunch of people in it, and it's very fun. We're trying to kind of bring the old nightclub act back. A lot of people are doing little small cabaret shows, but we wanted a big, flashy.
So yours is a big cabaret show?
Yeah. It's a big show. There's about 12 people in it, and big band.
Because I was going to say it sounds like Cosmopolitan Cabaret, which is also programmed by Alpha Musical
Theater.
But they do more small things, I think. Mm-hmm. John, I notice in your bio that you acted in all three series of Law and Order. And
I
when
sure
it was
did.
Announced that the previous season was the final season of the mothership of Law and Order, it actually became a political story. The mayor of New York got involved because so many actors in New York have gotten regular work or intermittent work on one or other of the Law and Order shows. Can you talk about that?
About Law and Order being canceled?
Yeah, yes.
Well, they still, fortunately, they still have the SVU and CI.
Yes.
So they still have the two series going there. So, I mean, listen, it had a great run. We should all run that long. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So.
But it's a pretty common item in the bio or the resume of actors.
It is,
who live
but you know, it's
York.
Funny. I have a lot of friends who've never done it. And it's so funny going to those auditions because you'll see, you know, incredible actors that you've worked with. They're waiting around to say, guilty. And you get like, really? I always think you could just go up to somebody on the street and say, well, here, you can say that and you can say that. And here's some money and we'll pay you to do it. Because it just, it's funny to me.
Yeah. Gary Beach, you mentioned Mel Brooks. In your background, you acted in The Producers on Broadway. You won a Tony. And you also acted in the 2005 film. So you know Mel Brooks pretty well now, I guess.
Yeah, well, of course, when I was going to see his movies, I didn't know him at all.
Yeah.
You know, but I love that was a wonderful experience. I look back on it with great fondness.
I bet. Well, Gary Beach, he plays King Arthur in Spamalot. John Shearer plays Sir Robin in other roles. Leslie Margarita plays the Lady of the Lake. They're all in Spamalot. It opens Friday at Sacramento Music Circus. It runs through July 18th. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Chicano artist Jose Montoya. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tell us what you think about Insight. Our email is insight@capradio.org. Today on Capital Public Radio News, California community colleges are forced to borrow money or dip into savings during the state budget impasse. Also, Northern California's long, cool, wet spring has had a double-edged impact on local rafting companies. It meant the rafting season was late in starting, but has also created great conditions for the summer. Those stories and more on All Things Considered. The great Chicano artist and poet Jose Montoya has a new book out that he both wrote and illustrated. Titled Los Compas, it's the tale of two guys from New Mexico and their dog. One unusual feature of the book, it reads from right to left. He's in our studio, Jose Montoya. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
I read that the origin of this book was a series of napkin sketches. Is that true?
Right. Yeah, I began drawing this trio, a guy and his partner and the dog, some time back. And titles are Los Compas means the buddies, compadres, and Chale Gallego is kind of a play on words about our cultural background. We're Mexican, Indian, Spanish, all of that. So the two compas are, one's a tall kind of Don Quixote type dude, and that's Chale. Chale is in the barrio short for Charles or Carlos.
Oh, okay.
Or Charlie. And Gallego, I wanted to put him in that Gaelic or Spanish, yeah. New Mexico. They still believe that they came from Spain instead of Mexico, and that's where my people are from. And Shorty is just his sidekick who
Shorty is the dog.
No, Shorty is his running partner. His partner. I don't know if I have a name for the dog. So these are two barrio activists that are always together and always getting in trouble and out of trouble. But they're barrio icons, kind of.
When you started drawing these sketches, did you have a book in mind?
Not really. I think I started first using this trilogy, these three entities, the dog and Chale and Shorty, in the barrio, just dealing with neighborhood issues, talking about problems in the barrio. And that's about it.
The book is described as an almost silent graphic cuento. What does that mean?
Well, a cuento is the old New Mexico tradition of the storytellers, the cuentistas, they used to call them. These are the people that came around in the mountain villages during fiestas and told stories. And everybody looked forward to when these storytellers were going to be coming in, because they came with all kinds of stories, from stories that were so incredible that people were in awe. And later I found out that they were, you know, Arabian Nights and probably English literature or whatever, but they had it down to where they could take it to those mountain villages and put it across as something that they would enjoy listening to.
Yes.
So that was what I was playing with, my New Mexico upbringing, I guess, which still has a lot of Hispanic, Spanish, not Mexico thing about it.
Do you go back often to New Mexico?
I still have relatives. I have land there. And I still try and go at least once a year.
You say you have land there. Do you think about ever going back to live there?
No. In fact, I think I came into this land, I wasn't looking for land, it just kind of was part of what was left to me, and now I have to deal with it, and it's there in case I should ever want to go, you know, maybe build a log cabin up in the mountains. It's up in the mountains.
So I was just going to ask, where is it? It's up in the mountains, then.
Yeah, it's from Albuquerque towards Moriarty, there's the Sandia Mountains, and those villages were where I grew up in.
Yeah. Do you know people just like Chale and Shorty, the guys in your book?
I think we all do, you know, but I kind of compiled a lot of different entities that I knew into these two. Shorty's, you know, the more quiet, down-to-earth guy. Chalice, the philosopher, kind of always spouting Shakespeare or whatever. And he doesn't even know what it means, but
Are you more one of them? Are you one of them?
I'm probably both. And the dog. Yeah, I'm afraid I have to say that I can relate to all three.
My guest is Jose Montoya, artist, poet, Sacramento State art professor, co-founder of the Royal Chicano Air Force. His new book is titled Los Compas, and it's about two guys from New Mexico and their dog. I read that the book is to be read from right to left. Why is that?
Yeah, well, it's kind of like a codices, and it's kind of difficult to explain visually what it is, but you unfold it, and there's writing on both sides. And like an accordion.
Yes, I was just going to say, because you're opening it up right now. Of course, our listeners can't see that, but it looks a bit like an accordion when you open it. Yeah. Why did you choose that style?
Well, that was Stephanie. She's, I don't know what to call
her. Publisher?
My publisher, my editor, my... she knows what to do with these things that I don't. And she's responsible for this jam.
But still, you could make it like that and read it from left to right. It's an unusual way to read, in at least in our culture.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
What do you do nowadays? Are you still, how actively involved are you in art and poetry?
Probably quite a bit, and very involved in community activities. I'm an old community activist from the old days. Grew up in the farm worker struggle, and I taught here at Sac State for almost 30 years. And so that's pretty much where it's at.
Yeah. You did many murals over the years. Are you still
doing
murals?
Yeah, I belong to a group called the Rebel Chicano Art Front.
The Rebel Chicano Art Front.
Yeah.
As opposed to the Royal Chicano Air Force.
Well, yeah, in those days we were very much into the political side of who we were as artists. And there was a group in the Bay Area that both me and my compadre Esteban Villa, who also taught here, belonged to before we came to Sac State, which was called the Mexican American Liberation Art Front. And it had the initials MALAF, MALAF.
Mm-hmm.
And once we landed at Sac State, we thought we should, our students kind of wanted to get something that was more here, more homegrown from Sacramento. And they came up with the Rebel Chicano Art Front. And they were into that kind of revolutionary fervor of the times. And we said, but we cannot put nobody's initials, just the initials of the organization. So it would only have RCAF. And wherever we did a mural or posters, people wanted to know what our connection was with the Royal Canadian Air Force, I guess.
Yes.
And we said, no, it's the Royal Chicano Air Force. Somebody made it into a Royal Chicano Air Force, and it kept the initials RCAF, and it worked, and we got away with not having to apologize to the Canadians.
Seems like you have happy memories of that time.
Yeah, they were great times. You know, they were great times for so many reasons. First of all, having come out of the Korean War, the GI Bill allowed me to go to college. That allowed me to get a teaching position or training so that I could become an art teacher. And I started teaching high school up in Wheatland, north of here. And then when things opened up at Sac State during the movement, we were brought into a master's program that was there. And Steven and I both were offered jobs in the art department at Sac State. And so we began there, and there was an organization I think I mentioned before from the Steven and I belonged to called the Mexican American Liberation Art Front, but this being Sacramento, they wanted it to be a Sacramento thing. So we call it the Rebel Chicano Art Front, but that we were never going to use our names or only the initials as RCAF. And people began to wonder what our connection was to the Royal Canadian Air Force. And when somebody said, no, it's the Royal Chicano Air Force, really, you guys fly, you bet. We fly Adobe airplanes.
But you paint, though, and you draw.
Yeah.
Jose Montoya, his new book is called Los Compas, and it's released tomorrow evening at 7 at the Book Collector in Midtown Sacramento. That's 24th Street between J and K, and Jose will be there. Jose Montoya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Natalie Rothfeld, Susan Morar, Esteban Hernandez, and Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard, and thank you for joining us. We'll be right back. A stalemate between Sacramento City Schools and its teachers' union ended last month when the union agreed to concessions. On the next Insight, we'll hear about what the teachers gave up and how the district is doing financially. You'll also hear from a parent. Plus, we'll check in on issues in the news with Sacramento Bee columnist Marcus Bretone. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.